Chapter 9. The 9/11 Plot. The 9/11 plot amply demonstrates the central importance that bin Laden plays in al-Qaeda. While bin Laden did not involve himself in the details of the 9/11 operation, he was its ultimate commander. In 2002, when the Al Jazeera reporter Yosri Fouda interviewed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin Asheba, who had together coordinated the 9/11 attacks, bin Asheba told Fouda that he had traveled to Pakistan from Hamburg in late August 2001 to ensure that bin Laden was apprised of the timing of the attacks 5 days before they happened. Bin Laden's supervisory role in the attacks on Washington, D.C. and New York is amplified in the 9/11 Commission report, which explains that in 1999, bin Laden appointed the Egyptian Mohammed Atta to be the lead hijacker. The report concludes, "It is clear then that bin Laden and Atef, his military commander, were very much in charge of the operation." Osama bin Laden discussed the 9/11 plot in a private meeting with a Saudi supporter that was recorded on videotape by al-Qaeda sometime in November 2001. The tape was recovered in Jalalabad by U.S. forces after the fall of the Taliban. What follows are excerpts from that tape. "We calculated in advance the number of casualties from the enemy who would be killed based on the position of the tower. We calculated that the floors that would be hit would be 3 or 4 floors. I was the most optimistic of them all due to my experience in this field of construction. I was thinking that the fire from the gas in the plane would melt the iron structure of the building and collapse the area where the plane hit and all the floors above it only. This is all that we had hoped for." Members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan were overjoyed when the first plane hit the building, so I said to them, "Be patient. The difference between the first and the second plane hitting the towers was 20 minutes, and the difference between the first plane and the plane that hit the Pentagon was 1 hour. We had notification since the previous Thursday that the event would take place that day. We had finished our work that day and had the radio on. It was 5:30 p.m., our time. Immediately, we heard the news that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. After a little while, they announced that another plane had hit the World Trade Center. The brothers who heard the news were overjoyed." Suleiman Abu Khaif, al-Qaeda's spokesman, recalls sitting with bin Laden as the events of 9/11 unfolded on television. "I was sitting with the Sheikh bin Laden in a room. Then I left to go to another room where there was a TV set. The TV broadcasted the big event. The scene was showing an Egyptian family sitting in their living room. They exploded with joy. Do you know when there is a soccer game and your team wins? It was the same expression of joy. There was a subtitle that read, 'In revenge for the children of Al-Aqsa, the Palestinians, Osama bin Laden executes an operation against America.' So I went back to the Sheikh bin Laden, who was sitting in a room with 50 or 60 people. I tried to tell him about what I saw, but he made a gesture with his hands, meaning, 'I know, I know.'" In the summer of 2001, Jamal Ismail was working as a television correspondent in Pakistan with Abu Dhabi Television. He remembers that a competing network announced some big news from al-Qaeda's leaders. In late June 2001, Bakr Atyani, the bureau chief of MBC, Middle East Broadcasting Corporation, saw bin Laden in Afghanistan with Ayman al-Zawahiri and Abu Hafs. Some aides of bin Laden informed him unofficially that, "We have a big gift for the Intifada. We are going to strike against American interests more than the coal." The news was realized through MBC on the 23rd of June, 2001. The Taliban government denied this story and forced Abu Hafs to deny it immediately. After that report, Mullah Omar asked bin Laden, "Do not do anything on Afghan soil without informing us." Bakr Atyani, the former Middle East Broadcasting Company, MBC, bureau chief in Pakistan. Al-Qaeda contacted me. MBC, it's an important channel in the Middle East, so maybe this is the reason. They took me to their place around Kandahar. You couldn't really figure out or identify where you are, especially as it was desert. Osama was there with Ayman al-Zawahiri and Abu Hafs, Mohammed Atif. Osama was very easy when he received me. Bin Laden said that he had had prepared a mensaf, Arabian rice and meat dish, in my honor because I was his guest. When I started eating, I was embarrassed because the rice started falling through my fingers. Bin Laden looked at me and asked his assistant to go and fetch a knife and fork. I said, "Now I need to do my job. Please, can you bring the camera and then we can do the interview?" Then they said, "We'll bring the camera, but there's no interview." Bin Laden said to me that he may not be able to speak directly in front of the camera because he promised the Taliban that he would not give any press statements. Osama said, "You are here because there is some material which we are going to give to you. Footage of Al-Qaeda training and a celebration of the attack on the USS Cole. And some news. This is what we can give you now." When we were in front of the camera, Bin Laden didn't talk. Abu Hafs said, "In the next few weeks we will carry out a big surprise and we will strike or attack American and Israeli interests." And that was the news they were giving me that day. I asked Osama, "Would you please confirm that?" He smiled. That was when the camera was not recording. I believe that was the main reason they had brought me there. Well, for me it was big news, really. Abu Hafs, I realized that he is an important person. The fact that he was sitting with Osama. Abu Hafs is a very sharp person. You can see that from his eyes. Very sharp. He asked me specific questions about myself and about my channel. And I recall one statement he said, "We are expecting an American strike, yes, but we are ready to evacuate our bases within 30 minutes. When they brought their camera, Osama asked Zawahiri to come and sit near to him, so he came. Then Osama asked Abu Hafs. Abu Hafs refused and said, "I don't want to be in front of camera." But it was very clear that when the three were sitting in the same place, that they were having a good understanding. I believe that Abu Hafs was more close to Osama than Ayman. I think really no one took Al-Qaeda's threat seriously. I remember when I was interviewed by the Washington Post, July 8, 2001 edition. Their correspondent was Pamela Constable, and she asked me after the interview, "Do you really believe that they are going to do it?" And I told her, "Really, Pam, I believe they're going to do it, really, because it sounds serious." Vahid Mojeh, the former official in the Taliban Foreign Ministry. The journalists from MBC, upon leaving Afghanistan, reported this incident with much flair and created a huge international brouhaha. This incident helped escalate tensions between Osama and Taliban Foreign Minister Mutawakil to new heights. Mutawakil said that from this point on, the world would blame us for any attacks conducted against American targets anywhere. This incident created more tension inside the Taliban. Mutawakil was of the thinking that the Taliban took Osama and his followers as guests, but now they want to destroy Afghanistan. An Al-Qaeda member revealed that in early 2001, their leaders issued an order to obtain a list of volunteers for suicide missions. In Kandahar, Kabul, and East Afghanistan alone, 122 were found. If those in North Afghanistan had registered, the list would have been much longer. Al-Qaeda members spoke openly about the martyrs of their suicide operations and made no effort to conceal it. Long before the 9/11 attacks, Al-Qaeda talked in their gatherings of large-scale suicide missions against the U.S. Abu Walid al-Misri was the editor of Al-Imara, the Emirate magazine, the Arabic-language magazine of the Taliban. He also wrote a book about the Afghan Arabs, serialized in Al-Sharq al-Awsat newspaper in December 2004. An extract follows. Bin Laden's extremism reached the point where he believed that the United States was much weaker than some of those around him thought. He stated this at several meetings, and as evidence, he referred to what happened to the United States in Beirut when the bombing of the Marines' headquarters led them to flee from Lebanon in 1983. Some young Saudi followers confirmed to bin Laden his delusions from the gist of the experiences they had gained from their visits to the United States, namely that the country was falling and could bear only few strikes. Relying on what apparently he liked to hear and what he had repeatedly asserted, they stressed to him that the United States could not bear two or three strong strikes. This view was basically wrong and dangerous.
This ends Disc 10. The Osama bin Laden I Know. Disc 11.
According to Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer, there was a widespread belief, both inside the Taliban and among other Afghan leaders, that the United States might invade Afghanistan in the 6 months before the 9/11 attacks. These are his words. I met Afghan leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar in Tehran in April 2001. He openly supported bin Laden, saying, "Osama bin Laden is a great man, and I support his ideology, and I support his objectives. I know Osama bin Laden from many years. He is a good friend of mine, and he is a real mujahid." And he also predicted the Taliban government will fall this year. "America will attack Afghanistan this year." He said that in April 2001. He was telling me that the Americans will attack Afghanistan, Taliban government will fall, and then we'll continue our jihad against the Americans. It was 2nd or 3rd August 2001, maybe 40 days before 9/11 in Kabul. I started reporting the information which I took from a senior official in Taliban Defense Ministry that we believe Americans are going to invade Afghanistan, and they will do this before 15 October 2001. And justification for this would be either one of two options: Taliban got control of Afghanistan, or a big major attack against American interests, either inside America or elsewhere in the world. British cameraman Peter Juvenal was using a 23-year-old Afghan, Ahmed, as a gopher in Kabul and Peshawar in 2001. At the same time, Ahmed was also running errands for bin Laden. In the spring of 2001, Ahmed wanted to tell U.S. officials that al-Qaeda was planning to hijack jets in the United States to secure the release from U.S. prison of al-Qaeda's spiritual guru, the Egyptian blind Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. Ahmed approached Juvenal to help him. "I had been using Ahmed because he speaks very good English and Arabic, and he is very good on computers. In those days, Taliban were in control of Kabul. If I needed to see someone to talk to them about their story, I would send Ahmed. And so I was using him like a courier. I would have known him from about 99. And then one day he comes to me and he said, 'Would you help me get to a foreign country? It's too dangerous for me here.' And he started to tell me how he had been working for Osama as a courier, meeting people in Pakistan and taking them across the border, taking messages around for Osama, buying his food, taking messages to the internet, and logging on and receiving, printing, sending. He used to do his shopping for food. He said that bin Laden was into noodles and feta cheese, so he used to get him his feta for breakfast and noodles to have in the evenings. Ahmed needed an income. There was nothing else for a young kid in Kabul, so that's how he started getting involved. He looked a bit Arabic, and he got on quite well with them, speaking Arabic, and that's how he ended up in Osama's circle. Ahmed told me most Arabs and Afghans respect Osama because if they knew he was coming to a house, they would always make a special effort to make it comfortable in a room. And he would always sleep somewhere else on the floor with his gun. He wouldn't want any refineries and basically roughed it all the time. And they were all very impressed by that. Now, somewhere on the line, Ahmed tied up with the CIA, and al-Qaeda was trying to find him, and they had met his family. When someone gets involved with al-Qaeda, they actually come and meet your family members, and they know where they live and stuff like that. So they were trying to find him. In the Easter of 2001, Ahmed said that Al-Qaeda was planning to hijack an aircraft in the States, but he said that it was linked to try to get the blind Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman released. They were going to hijack an aircraft and then demand that the blind Sheikh be released. Then the fun starts, because I thought that maybe the FBI was a competent organization. One of the FBI agents was Lebanese, the other one was a New Yorker, and they said that they want me to go with Ahmed to Thailand. So I said, what about a visa? Ahmed said, oh, the FBI agents said it's okay, they've sorted it all out. And I thought, well, this is the FBI, they are the big boys on the block. And so we get to the check-in counter. I handed over Ahmed's passport and ticket, and they say, where is your visa? We go back to the hotel. There is this message on my machine. Don't tell anybody. We really fucked up, in the New York accent. So later, Ahmed goes off to Bangkok, the capital, and spends 3 weeks hanging out waiting for these dickheads, the FBI, to come back. Fairly soon after, 9/11 happens, and Ahmed and his whole family go off to the States. So obviously, they, the FBI, become a bit more serious after 9/11. This is the highly classified memo that President Bush received on August 6, 2001, about Al-Qaeda's determination to attack the United States, which was released during the course of the 9/11 Commission inquiries. The president was briefed about the memo at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, where he was taking a 4-week vacation. The memo further underlines the centrality of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman to Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. Clandestine foreign government and media reports indicate Bin Laden, since 1997, has wanted to conduct terrorist attacks in the U.S. Bin Laden implied in U.S. television interviews in 1997 and 1998 that his followers would follow the example of World Trade Center bomber Ramzi Youssef and bring the fighting to America. After U.S. missile strikes on his base in Afghanistan in 1998, Bin Laden told followers he wanted to retaliate in Washington. An Egyptian Islamic Jihad, EIJ, operative, said at the same time that Bin Laden was planning to exploit the operative's access to the U.S. to mount a terrorist strike. The Millennium Plotting in Canada in 1999 may have been part of Bin Laden's first serious attempt to implement a terrorist strike in the U.S. Convicted plotter Ahmed Ressam has told the FBI that he conceived the idea to attack Los Angeles International Airport himself, but that Bin Laden lieutenant Abu Zubaydah encouraged him and helped facilitate the operation. Ressam also said that in 1998, Abu Zubaydah was planning his own U.S. attack. Ressam says Bin Laden was aware of the Los Angeles operation. Although Bin Laden has not succeeded, his attacks against the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 demonstrate that he prepares operations years in advance and is not deterred by setbacks. Bin Laden associates surveilled our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam as early as 1993, and some members of the Nairobi cell planning the bombings were arrested and deported in 1997. Al-Qaeda members, including some who are U.S. citizens, have resided in or traveled to the U.S. for years, and the group apparently maintains a support structure that could aid attacks. Two Al-Qaeda members found guilty in the conspiracy to bomb our embassies in East Africa were U.S. citizens, and a senior EIJ member lived in California in the mid-1990s. A clandestine source said in 1998 that a Bin Laden cell in New York was recruiting Muslim-American youth for attacks. We have not been able to corroborate some of the more sensational threat reporting, such as saying that Bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft to gain the release of blind Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman and other U.S.-held extremists. Nevertheless, FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. The FBI is conducting approximately 70 full-field investigations throughout the U.S. that it considers bin Laden related. CIA and the FBI are investigating a call to our embassy in the UAE in May saying that a group of bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives. In mid-August 2001, I was alerted to a two-hour Al-Qaeda videotape circulating on clandestine chat rooms on the Internet. I found the tape to be of great interest as it was a professionally produced documentary that laid out all of Al-Qaeda's views and goals. The tape was the first production of Al-Qaeda's video production arm, Al-Sahab, The Clouds. A brief description of the tape follows. Bin Laden, dressed all in white, reads a poem recalling Saladin's victory over the Crusaders in the Middle Ages. Saladin, his sword dripping with the blood of the unbelievers. Bin Laden. Jews are free in Al-Quds, Jerusalem, to rape weak Muslim women and to imprison those young cubs who stand up to them. All the Arab presidents and kings betrayed the Muslim nation. It is better to seek out death than to wait for it. Film of Israeli soldiers striking out at Palestinian women and of a young Palestinian boy who is shot, played over and over again. Anguished narrator. The Jews broke their word. We've been suffering for 50 years. Shots of Israeli soldiers pushing Palestinian women, youths being shot at, bodies being dragged away. Bin Laden punching the air for emphasis. The blood of Muslims is the cheapest of all blood. Abu Hafs, Al-Qaeda's military commander. The scum of the earth, Jews and Israelis, have invaded our holy places. Bin Laden. We speak of the American government, but it is in reality an Israeli government, because if we look into the most sensitive departments of the government, whether it is the Pentagon or the State Department or the CIA, you find that it is the Jews who have the first word inside the American government. Consequently, they use America to execute their plans throughout the world. This last comment from bin Laden is quite illuminating. I was always puzzled by the fact that bin Laden, who had declared war on the Crusaders and the Jews in 1998, had hitherto not attacked Israeli or Jewish targets. After the 9/11 attacks, I came to realize that for bin Laden and his rabidly anti-Semitic colleagues, the Pentagon was a Jewish target. I also found Al-Qaeda's new videotape alarming, as it seemed to presage a major Al-Qaeda attack. I emailed the following letter to John Burns, generally regarded as the New York Times' finest foreign correspondent. The 9/11 attacks were only 3 weeks away. August 17, 2001. John, I think there is a major story to be told wrapping around the new bin Laden videotape and the various threats against U.S. facilities in past months, which can paint both a compelling picture of the bin Laden organization today and responsibly suggest that an Al-Qaeda attack is in the works. Let me try and lay it out for you. As you know, there were very strong indications of attacks on U.S. targets in Yemen in June. Also in June, two men were picked up in New Delhi who said they were planning to blow up the busy visa section of the U.S. embassy. There were also indications that they planned to blow up the American embassy in Bangladesh. On July 18th, the State Department issued a statement that the USG has strong indications that individuals may be planning imminent terrorist actions against U.S. interests in the Arabian Peninsula. Clearly, Al-Qaeda was and is planning something. Now comes the two-hour bin Laden recruitment propaganda tape, brief snippets of which were shown on CNN, and Reuters ran a story about it when it surfaced in Kuwait in late June. But no one has looked at the entire tape, or if they have, they did not bother to sit down and translate the whole thing. The tape is in a real player format which can be played on Windows. Also, no one has thought to put the videotape in the context of Al-Qaeda's modus operandi, which is to subtly indicate a plot is in the works before it takes place. We saw this in May 1998, when bin Laden held a press conference in Afghanistan where he talked of good news in coming weeks, and a few days later told ABC News that he predicted a black day for America. 9 weeks later, the embassies in Africa were bombed. The Taliban later banned bin Laden from talking to journalists. Now bin Laden observes the letter but not the spirit of the ban by making himself available to his media arm, who distributes his videotaped statements to Arabic media outlets around the world, which are then in turn picked up by Western media. A few months before the coal bombing in Yemen, as you know, a tape appeared which is notable for two things. Bin Laden is wearing the Jambiya Yemeni dagger, which he had never previously worn in any of the dozens of photos that exist of him, and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, specifically called for attacks on American forces in Yemen. This tape is of more than passing interest to U.S. investigators and again shows how al-Qaeda subtly signals its next move. Now, the videotape I have in hand is circulating around the Middle East, which has all sorts of juicy stuff on it detailed below, not least of which is that on the tape, bin Laden makes a set of statements taking credit for a number of anti-American actions, his most explicit and wide-ranging to date. The skillfully edited 2-hour-long recruitment propaganda tape is a useful distillation of bin Laden's views and al-Qaeda's tactics. On the tape, bin Laden and his advisers make impassioned speeches about Muslims being attacked in Chechnya, Kashmir, Iraq, Israel, Lebanon, Indonesia, and Egypt. Speeches which are laid over graphic footage of Muslims being killed, beaten, and imprisoned. The videotape devotes 10 to 15 minutes to images of Palestinians under attack by Israeli soldiers. There is also an important clue as to when the tape was possibly edited together, as it shows Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, which implies the tape was put together in March 2001, or sometime thereafter, as Barak, Sharon's predecessor, resigned at the end of February. For bin Laden, however, the greatest insult to Muslims is the continued presence of Americans in the Holy Land of Arabia. Bin Laden says, "These Americans brought women and Jewish women who can go anywhere in our Holy Land," adding, "the Arab rulers worship the God of the White House." These statements are made over images of the Saudi royal family members meeting American leaders such as Colin Powell. Bin Laden says that Muslims must seek revenge for these insults. "If you don't fight, you will be punished by God." The Saudi exile says the solution to these problems is that Muslims should travel to Afghanistan and receive training about how to do jihad. The tape then shows hundreds of bin Laden's masked followers training at his Al-Farouk camp in eastern Afghanistan, holding up black flags and chanting in Arabic, "Fight evil." Bin Laden's fighters shoot off anti-aircraft guns and RPGs, hold up their Qurans and their Kalashnikovs, run across obstacle courses, dive into pools of water, blow up buildings, and shoot at images of President Clinton. Bin Laden himself looses off some rounds from an automatic rifle. Chillingly, the tape also shows dozens of young boys, most of whom appear to be around 10, dressed in military camouflage uniforms, chanting for jihad, while tackling the same obstacle courses seen earlier on the tape. Towards the end of the tape, bin Laden implies more action against the United States. "The victory of Islam is coming, and the victory of Yemen against the USS Cole will continue." The entire video is now available in a DVD format and is also circulating in clandestine chat rooms on the Internet, according to those familiar with bin Laden's organization. According to a Saudi dissident, "My information is that these threats on the videotape are genuine, that bin Laden's followers are making real preparations against more than one American target." I would love to collaborate on this story with you if you felt it made sense. And perhaps I am overestimating what I think is a really important story. Look forward to talking to you. Best, Peter. John Burns subsequently wrote a prescient story headlined, "On Videotape, Bin Laden Charts Violent Future," which was posted to the New York Times website on September 9, 2001, but because of an editing dispute, the newspaper did not run a version of Burns's story until a day after the 9/11 attacks. In an Orwellian rewriting of history, the Times took Burns' pre-9/11 story off its website, an episode an editor later conceded to be a bad screw-up. Excerpts of Burns' story follow. The image on the grainy videotape is mesmerizing. A tall, slim, middle-aged Arab man with the bushy beard, white robes, and draped white headcloth of a devout Muslim standing before a gathering somewhere in Afghanistan. He is reading an Arabic poem, apparently his own, on papers that riffle in a breeze. In the verses, read at the wedding in Afghanistan of his oldest son earlier this year, Mr. bin Laden declares his purpose, killing Americans and Jews, more starkly than ever. Proudly, he salutes the suicide bombing of the American destroyer Cole in the Yemeni port of Aden last October, in which 17 American sailors died, and promises more attacks. Mr. bin Laden uses the tape to spell out a continuing nightmare for his principal enemies, the United States and Israel. He promises an intensified holy war that includes aid to Palestinians fighting Israel, an important shift in emphasis, according to intelligence analysts. In recent years, through a series of violent attacks, Mr. bin Laden's main focus has been on driving American forces from the Arabian Peninsula. He also outlines plans for an expansion of his terrorist training operations in Afghanistan, saying that the Taliban, the Islamic militant movement that has sheltered him since 1996, have built an ideal, purified Islamic state that provides the perfect base for a worldwide holy war against infidels. The same day that the Times chose to hold Burns's story, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Afghan commander who represented the only obstacle to the Taliban taking over the whole of Afghanistan, was assassinated by two al-Qaeda members posing as television reporters. Former Taliban official Vahid Mojeh recounts how Massoud's killers insinuated themselves into Afghanistan. Taliban Foreign Minister Mutawakil was planning to close down Markaz El Alam, an al-Qaeda network that fronted itself by printing propaganda for the Taliban. Here, magazines in Arabic, Urdu, Pashto, English, and Dari were printed. One day, some cardboard boxes containing computer equipment arrived at the offices of Markaz al-Elam in Kandahar. The equipment had been shipped from Pakistan. The next day, three people came to the center. One of them was Abu Hani, another was named Abid, and the third was introduced as Karim. These two last ones had recently arrived in Kandahar and claimed to live in Belgium. They collected from amongst the boxes a big box which had been marked and had a video camera in it and claimed that it was theirs. Once the box was opened, the Taliban members present at the room were surprised to see a very old camera in it, which made Abid and Karim very anxious. The Taliban took notice of Abid and Karim's nervousness. 3 days later, the same three people came to the center saying they had an appointment with Foreign Minister Mutawakil. When the interview with Mutawakil was over, the translator asked to receive a copy of the interview video. They agreed, but this video never arrived. It seemed that these three people had intentionally arranged the interview with Mutawakil and taken the camera with them to quench any curiosity raised the previous day. This showed extreme cautiousness on their part. Abid and Karim later went to Kabul and from there to northern Afghanistan, where they were able to assassinate Ahmad Shah Massoud.